The Spectator's prestigious Economic Innovator of the Year Award in partnership with Investec are now in their sixth year. Wherever you're based in the UK, we can't wait to hear about the success of your business and the impact you're making on the economy and society in 2023. Applications are now open and will close June 16th. To learn more and apply, please visit spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
We are delighted to be joined by Sarah Woods. Sarah grew up in the West Midlands in a Punjabi household. After reaching the final of BBC's Britain's Best Home Cook, she left her career in the pharmaceutical industry for food. Her first book, Desi Kitchen, has just been published by Michael Joseph and explores and celebrates British and South Asian fusion recipes featuring the Desi communities who created them. Sarah, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah, as listeners know, we always start this podcast in the same place with a question about your earliest memories of food. So what are your earliest memories of food?
Now, that's a difficult question because I can't even remember what day of the week it is normally, let alone casting my memory back that far. And, you know, it flummoxed me a bit because I suppose there isn't a single memory in terms of that mouthful of food, and it's more immersive. So, you know, I remember my earliest memories because my grandparents brought us up. And they grew their own veg, their fruit and veg. And my earliest memory is actually making a mint chutney, which we call a budanaki chutney, because our parents and grandparents very much believed in child labour. So we were always roped in into making everything, particularly the girls. You know, it was a female domain, the kitchen. And I remember making this mint chutney in one of these like odious looking contraptions, because there were no stick blenders, there were no food processors back then. It was almost like they called it a grinder, but I'm not quite sure what the actual name of this contraption is. But you'd have an opening and you'd put in your mint, your onion, your chilies and tomatoes. And then there's a lever that you'd kind of turn and it would grind, and these menacing looking blades would grind, you know, whatever you'd put into it. And then they were captured into this like thing at the bottom, a receptacle. So it's this chutney is my earliest memory, and being involved in making it, picking the actual mint leaves. I remember it being a nice sunny day, not dissimilar to today. And it's those zingy flavours, because we'd often have this chutney it was a flavour bomb to bring lots of different dishes to life. So that's my earliest memory, is the whole preparation and the growing and this whole immersive experience, really.
And was that time in the kitchen something you immediately took to as a child?
Yes, I did. I mean, my mum says that I was always a good eater. You know, I don't remember that far back, but I was one of her children that would always just, you know, accept every single mouthful and then want more and then probably nick some food off my brother as well. So, you know, sorry, Liv, but I've lost my thread then.
Did you take to cooking and to being in the kitchen as a child, or was it something that was I don't want to say forced upon you, but was it something that was enjoyable from an early stage?
Well, because I was always greedy and I had an interest, I would sometimes be in the kitchen and actually help my grandma and my mum prepare the food, because I had a keen interest. And of course, then you get the perks, because you get to taste the food before anybody else. You get to taste elements as it's being prepared. So, you know, that was a great incentive. And that interest just developed because, you know, I was always interested in eating the food. And it's always good when you're part of a big family to get to the food first. And the best way of learning and also ensconcing myself into the whole cooking experience was to help. And, you know, there's an oral tradition within South Asian cultures. You know, you don't get books, you don't get heirlooms that are passed on to you with beautiful handwritten recipes. It's very much an oral tradition, and you learn by doing, you learn by seeing, you learn by listening.
Mm. And so what were mealtimes like in your family?
Chaotic. Because, as I say, we had a big family. So in South Asian culture, it's a tradition that my father was the eldest. So, you know, the grandparents normally lived with the eldest son. And, you know, I'm one of five. He was one of six. So often my aunts and uncles would come to the house too. And we'd have to have several sittings for dinner. And it was just everybody, it was all hands on deck. I think every mealtime was almost an event because there were so many mouths to feed. And, you know, we don't have just one dish. There's lots of dishes. So you'll have perhaps, you know, a couple of vegetable dishes. You know, you'll have the fresh chapatis. You know, you'll have the condiments. I like the fresh chutney, which we'd make very regularly. And you'll have the meat dishes or the rice. So it was quite a production, in all honesty. And then the chaos is just getting everybody fed. So, you know, it's the children first, and then, you know, then the grandparents, and then, you know, mum and dad, really. So, you know, it was chaos.
And what about outside the home? What was school food like for you?
School food was amazing. School food, I felt, was just so exotic. You know, fish fingers, fish and chips. And I'm quite obsessed with traditional puddings. So, you know, I loved the whole... We had... This, I don't know whether you guys did have this at your school, but we had green custard, which was flavoured with mint. Yeah, do you know what? Not everybody was blessed enough to have that, but it was glorious. And did you have that with chocolate sponge?
Yes, but if they didn't have it, they look at you as if you're mad. If you've had it, you're like, oh, yeah, of course, mint custard at school with chocolate cake. Otherwise,
green,
like,
yeah, it's green.
Are you having some fever dream? We definitely had mint custard.
Yeah, have you been eating magic mushrooms? What do you mean, green custard? But there was also pink custard. Did you have that? Strawberry-flavoured pink custard.
I'm not sure ours was flavoured. Yeah. Not sure it was ever that good. But
and chocolate.
We had cornflake tart as well. Cornflake tart and chocolate
cake. Oh,
my good
grief. Yes, yes, yeah. Good Lord. I would crawl over broken glass for that. That cornflake tart with custard or with cream or both, and that Bakewell tart. I have a weakness for Bakewell tart too. So yeah, it was all that stuff. And I actually have quite a traumatic memory from school because I guess I went through a phase. So I think I must have asked my mum that, you know, I want to go through a phase of having packed lunches. So my mum, back then, it's ingrained in the South Asian psyche that waste is sacrilege. So back then, we didn't have recycling bins. So what she'd do is she'd reuse tubs of butter or tubs of margarine, and she'd put leftover curries in them. And there was no My Little Pony lunchbox for me, no Care Bears lunchbox for me. It was an empty tub of butter. However, I was in a rush to get to school one day and I picked up the wrong tub. So I actually picked up an aloo palak dish, which, you know, I picked up a leftover curry by accident. So, you know, starving, you get to lunch at school and all of my friends are getting out their ham and cheese sandwiches and whatever else. And here's me, I open my lid and it's this leftover curry. So it's first of all the horror that A, I've picked up the wrong tub. But then you're conscious of the smell because it's like, am I going to, you know, stink out the dinner hall? And then it's like, oh, my God, put this away. And it's just that the colour just, you know, that the blood just rushed from my face and thinking, what am I going to have for lunch? You know, I'm bereft. You know, what am I going to have? And, you know, one of the lovely dinner ladies took pity on me. She saw, obviously, this all unfold in front of her. And then I got to the front of the queue. I think I must have been in tears at that stage. And I got to the front of the queue and I had fish and chips, the biggest fish, battered fish you've ever seen. And I was just so deliriously happy. I have a very strong love for dinner ladies and school dinners in general.
Sarah, as well as learning to cook from your grandmother's father when you were younger, I've also read that you grew up on a diet of cookery shows. Can you tell us a bit about that and which were your favourites?
I did.
How they influence your interest in cooking?
I guess because, you know, we didn't have many books at home because we have this oral tradition and, you know, always British food and European food was always the taste of the exotic for me because we kind of had Indian food on tap at home. So, you know, I was always dazzled by pies and pastries and whatnot. And I remember as a child, because it was back then, we only had four channels. So, you know, there wasn't much by way of TV. But I would run home from school to watch Ready, Steady, Cook. Did you guys ever watch that? Ainsley Harriet.
Absolutely.
In his pomp.
Yeah.
Percy Pepper is out. And I think he was my gateway drug in many ways because I just couldn't get enough of, you know, he had a whole roster of different chefs and I couldn't get enough of learning through TV cookery shows. And, you know, I mean, I used to love in the evenings you'd have Nigel Slater or Nigella, Delia, Rick Stein, Mary Berry. So these are all of the TV shows that I kind of grew up with. And, you know, I learned from these wonderful TV cooks. And when Jamie Oliver broke out in The Naked Chef, I mean, that was just such excitement. So I feel throughout my life, you know, I've just been so drawn to TV cookery and learning through that through that vehicle, really.
Did you at any point growing up and before you left home, did you want to pursue a career in food? Because this has become a second career for you. You previously worked in a corporate role in the pharmaceutical industry. Was there always a burning ambition to go and do what you're doing now?
I've always been obsessed with food because my grandmother and my mother was obsessed. It's kind of, you know, all Punjabis are obsessed with food, to be perfectly honest. And I've never really known what I wanted to do. I've known what I was passionate about. And I think those people that know from an early age what their interests are professionally are very blessed. So I kind of fell into, you know, the career that I was in and, you know, fell into the corporate space. But it was never anything that really set my soul alight. And it was, I was approaching 40. And, you know, that's when I was thinking, look, you know, I just thought to myself, you know, I want to do something that I'm passionate about, that really drives me and fuels, you know, my interest, because we spend so much of our time at work, don't we? So it's really important to enjoy what we do. And it was always food. And it became apparent, it became obvious that, look, this was always my first love. And wouldn't it be wonderful to base a career around this? So I think it took me a while to realise it, but there was only ever one true calling.
And can you tell us a bit about the steps that you took once you decided that you wanted to have a career in food?
Well, I guess it was my appearance. So I started a website and I joined social media with great trepidation because, you know, I'm a bit of a technophobe. It's not really my natural habitat. And I joined Instagram and I launched my own website because, you know, I was passionate about making authentic home cooking accessible to everybody. And literally 2 weeks later, I was contacted by a TV production company. And at first I thought, you know, this is a hoax. You know, who are these people? And then I checked it all out and they were legit. And they wanted me to appear on a TV cooking show called Best Home Cook. So, you know, it was a long process, long interview process, you know, and it was grueling because we had to go and do some test cooks and all the rest of it. But I got on this show and I guess that was the career pivot for me, was just my eyes being opened up to what was possible, really. Unfortunately for me, the timing was a bit off because it was aired just as the pandemic struck. So, you know, it was difficult, as it would have been for many people. But, you know, I thought, nonetheless, I won't be deterred. So I decided to go to Chef's Academy. There's an academy in Devon, in Ashburton, to hone my cooking skills. And during lockdown, I started a food collection business, which developed some kind of cult following. And I wrote a book proposal. And that was that. There was no turning back after that. The rest is history.
Tell us about the experience of ending up on a cooking competition, particularly, you know, bearing in mind that you hadn't conventionally, now when you're looking at Bake Off or MasterChef, you know, people apply and they've sort of been driven by ambition and this is what they've dreamed of their whole lives. You were approached on this. Like, what was it like? Did it meet your expectations?
I mean, it's definitely a you know, a baptism of fire, I think, TV initially, because, you know, you have no expectations. But it's tough. I mean, it's long hours and it's an early call. And then we filmed at, I think I was just very wide-eyed because it was filmed at Pinewood Studios. And then to see the goddess that is Mary Berry in person, you know, I think I might have struggled to string a sentence together the first time I met her. And, you know, the queen of pasta, you know, in Angela Hartnett. And, you know, obviously there's Chris Bavin with his produce expert and the fragrant Claudia Winkleman. It was just a little bit, I was a little bit starstruck. But then, you know, after a couple of hours, you kind of get used to it. And it's like, oh, hi, Mary. Oh, hi, Claudia. And, you know, it just becomes natural. And I've always been competitive. I think when you're one of five and I'm number four, so as a younger child, you're always definitely very competitive because you have to be to survive. But I thought it was a wonderful experience. You know, it was, it was difficult. It wasn't easy, but I just loved it. It was a great opportunity to learn as well. I felt I really learned so much in terms of my own cookery and how that developed, and through doing research for the various tests and challenges and whatnot. It was just, it's almost life affirming. It you know, I absolutely loved every minute of it.
And so your new book, Desi Kitchen, explores food in the UK, but from different areas of South Asia and how it relates to those different communities. Can you tell us a bit about that and things that listeners might not perhaps be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I feel I should explain what the word Desi means. So Desi is a person of birth or heritage from the Indian subcontinent that lives abroad. So that includes somebody like myself. I was born and bred in the West Midlands, and my granddad came from the Punjab in the north of India, like many immigrants did after the Second World War. You know, there were acute labour shortages, and, you know, even up through the 60s and 70s, there was a call that went out to citizens of the Commonwealth to meet these labour shortages and help rebuild the economy. So he answered that call. And in terms of Desi food, I guess it's South Asian cookery is just so diverse. There is no such thing as Indian food in many ways because it's so regional. It's so nuanced. It's hyper seasonal. There's too much diversity. So, you know, my starting point was very much, well, how do we make Indian food accessible? But then, you know, it's exploring what Indian food actually is and actually applying that Desi element too. And I felt that, you know, I needed to look at all of these different communities to tell a complete story. And then also it's getting into, you know, how the food has evolved. So not only the regional cookery of each of these different regions, but then also how that's absorbed the regions of Britain and the new influences for these people that have made the move and settled in a different country. So I think there's a story to tell with each of the recipes. I wanted there to be a strong sense of this recipe, this chapter. It tells a story of this community and it tells a story of this culture.
And how did you go about researching that and meeting the communities that were perhaps slightly outside your own?
Well, I think that's a great question because I can talk with authority about Punjabi food, but then I wanted to, you know, it was a learning curve for myself to understand particularly South Asian food because the traditions in the north of India are very different to, you know, cooking techniques and methods from the south of India. And I sought out people from each of these communities because I wanted them to be brought to life in an authentic way. So I also wanted to delve into these kitchens and see how they're using spice, to see how, you know, what techniques they're using and all the rest of it. So I sought out people from each of these communities to kind of get under the skin of that, you know, and also to understand their stories and their experiences, because I think in order to understand a food culture, you need to understand its people. So in each of the chapters, there is a person that represents that community to really make it authentic.
And Sarah, you also regularly host supper clubs in your hometown of Wilmslow. Can you tell us about those? And are supper clubs something that almost kind of replicate aspects of the Desi community and the way that they eat?
Yeah, I mean, the supper clubs, as soon as lockdown was lifted, I was able to do the supper clubs. But because before that, it was very much it was having to be, you know, a food collection, really, that we'd operate from home. But yeah, it's about, I guess, sharing the cultural context of each of these, the dishes. So the next one is actually in a couple of weeks. And it's almost like a tour of these various. So we start off with that street food, then we go to Nepal, then we go to the Punjab, then we go to Sri Lanka. And it's great to be able to, I guess, as a writer, as an author, you get to share recipes. But when you actually get to feed people, you see that reaction and that response in real time. It's a different feeling. And, you know, I love the idea of we've always been very hospitable. And I love the feeling of getting people together across a dinner table and over food. So it's wonderful to be able to host these supper clubs and feed people because I'm a natural feeder.
And when you're cooking in your kitchen at home, just for your family, not for a supper club, what is home cooking for you? It's obviously been an important part of your career at various different points. But what are you actually cooking?
Do you mean for me personally or for my family?
Oh, well, if there's a difference, tell me both.
Yeah, there's a difference. There's a difference. Because I guess, you know, it's about, particularly when you have kids, it's about keeping your audience happy. And my son is, you know, he's one of these finicky eaters. He's a little basic. So he's a vegetable dodger. And I love vegetables. So, you know, if I was unleashed just for my you know, just for my own self, it would be my husband, for example, has a dislike of aubergine and mushrooms, but these are ingredients that I love. So I think it would be, you know, a celebration of vegetables for starters. And, you know, I find so much satisfaction in persuading my husband in terms of, you know, he'll tell me, well, I don't like aubergines. And then very recently, I took a lot of satisfaction from the fact that he ate this smoked aubergine dish through sheer hunger because, you know, we were at an event and there wasn't any more food available. And he loved my smoked aubergine. So, you know, it's, I think if I cooked for myself, it would very much be a focus on vegetables. Sorry, Liv, have I answered your question?
Yes, you have. No, I'm really intrigued in the insight into your kitchen and what you make in there, I suppose, and what home cooking is for you. And I think I'm interested in you saying that, you know, it's sort of getting vegetables into your family and persuading them to like things. What did you have for supper last night?
For supper last night, it wasn't Indian. It was actually just a very quick stew that I'd cobbled together with chicken and beans, cannellini beans and butter beans and chorizo.
Oh, lovely.
It was just a cobbled together thing because we're moving. You know, it was just something quick to chuck together. But I guess, you know, when you're a mum and part of a family, it's about pleasing your audience, isn't it? And it's not always necessarily something that you personally would like to cook. It's about cooking something that will feed the whole family. And I guess that's a challenge that most families will face is keeping everybody happy.
So do you have a sweet tooth? Are there any South Asian puddings that you're particularly fond of?
I do have a sweet tooth, which I try to keep at bay just because I have a battle with my waistline and fitting into my jeans sometimes. And it doesn't actually include South Asian sweets, which I actually eschew, if I'm being honest. I prefer British puddings and, you know, anything with custard, anything with cream or ice cream or all of the above. But it's British puddings that I crave and I have an obsession with, really, rather than Indian mithai.
What's your favourite?
Oh, that's a tough question. My favourite? I think you can't beat a crumble. Because we grew our own fruit and veg. I guess it's that anchor to childhood, isn't it? And nostalgia. And there were always lots of fruit puddings on for crumble. So apple crumble or plum crumble. And we also grew pears, though I didn't think that was a stronger crumble as plum or apple. But crumble, I think it's simple, but it's just so pleasing. And it just ticks all of my boxes most of the time. It's something that I can never refuse, no matter how much I've eaten. It's something I can't resist.
And what for you is your ultimate comfort food? What would you cook if you just needed something just to take the edge off the day?
Comfort for me is carbs. So whether that's pastry, whether that's chips, or whether that's bread, or all three, ideally. It's I'm a bread lover. I'm a carb lover and committed to that cause. So that's the ultimate comfort. The ultimate actual dish for me, for want of a better phrase, I'm not sure you can describe this as a dish, would actually be carb on carb chip butty. So a slab of farmhouse white, slathered in lots of butter and loaded with chips with plenty of salt and vinegar. I mean, that is the ultimate comfort food.
And what about a desert island meal? We may have covered some of the options, we may not. What is your sort of last meal on earth, no holds barred?
Well, I've had to think long and hard about this, and that's a toughie. So I'm going to caveat that this is my three-course meal based on today, at this moment in time. It could change in an hour. It will definitely change tomorrow. So, you know, that's what I want to caveat. And I've actually made some notes about this. It's a bit nomadic, I warn you. So shall we go in with the first course?
Yes, please.
Okay, so my first course would actually be, and I did struggle with this, but it would be, because I wasn't sure whether I'd go for spicy mussels or a crab cake, but I am going to settle for a spicy crab cake with a nice salad dressed with a zingy dressing, some pickles and, you know, a garlicky writer. I think that's what I'd go for starters.
That sounds great. Next.
I'm also going to try and not to go too heavy with the carbs, I warn you with this, because, you know, I'm trying to keep it light so I can make it through to the end. Now, we're going to Greece for the mains and we're going for a chicken souvlaki. And, you know, I'd like that to come fully loaded with a metze as well. So there'd be hummus, there'd be tzatziki, there'd be roasted Mediterranean vegetables flavoured with lots of garlic and oregano, olives, and a lovely, it's got to have bread with the main course. So it'd be a lovely soft flatbread to mop all of that up. And it would have to have a side of paprika dusted chips. Because a meal's not a meal without chips.
And for pudding, Sarah, what would you have?
For the pudding, we're going to go to Austria. So it's a Kaiserschwan, which translates to being an emperor's mess. And it was a tough call because I was thinking, I was on the fence, but, you know, should it be a Black Forest gâteau or not? But I've gone for the Kaiserschwan because it's, you know, so heavy. Can I ask, before I go into the detail of this, will there be a cheese course?
There can be. If you would like a cheese course, we can arrange that, yeah.
I think there ought to be a cheese course as well. with the Kaiserschwan, so it's gorgeous, fluffy, thick shreds of pancake that's spiked with a bit of booze and a bit of raisins. And I'd have that with a spiced plum jam and clotted cream. So lots of dunking and dipping with my shreds of pancake into that. Kaiserschwan for pudding. And then I would have a cheese board with sauterne. I think you'd have to have sauterne to finish off the meal. So it would be a five cheese, made perhaps a nice sharp cheddar, a brie, a mild goat's cheese, and perhaps a mild blue too. And, you know, how many cheeses have we got to there? I think, is that four? There'd be a fifth.
One more.
Yeah, there'd be a fifth. What cheese would I go for? Gosh, maybe a Comté.
Nice.
And then, you know, we'd have to have that with a nice caramelized onion chutney and some grapes and some celery, so, you know, just to cleanse the palate a little bit.
And would you have a drink?
I would have a drink. Now, I wouldn't say that I'm any kind of connoisseur of wines, and I've actually gone into orange wine lately, but I'm not going to select orange wine though. I would go for a nice crisp and cold Pinot Grigio because that will complement the first two courses as well. So I'm quite restrained, and I'm going to hold out for that sauterne at the end.
I mean, it is 10:37. It feels very early in the day for me to be craving a five cheese course, but that is exactly what you've just done to me.
Yeah, sorry, you should have a selection of different crackers as well. Lots of different flavoured crackers.
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, that goes without saying, actually. I don't need to caveat that. I mean, that goes without saying.
I was actually thinking, I think we've got some Comté in the fridge. I might have a bit after we've recorded this.
I think you ought to. I think it would be the decent thing to do.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. And for listeners interested in Sarah's new book, Desi Kitchen, you can find it in all good retailers.
Listen, thank you very much, both.